author Desmond Bishop writes because he wants to engage the world around him. He started writing educational documentaries for the ABC in Sydney in 1975. Desmond has worked as a producer and a teacher. His next book, The Wizard of Z, tells the story of a boy who meets a wizard who teaches him to believe in himself. Desmond grew up in British colonial Southern Africa. Although he now resides in Asia, he enjoys travelling back to Nimbin, Australia, where he has a deep connection to the community. If you would like to read Desmond's book, just simply Google Goodbye Africa, Desmond Bishop.
Good day, Desmond. It's very wonderful to have you on the show here. I wanted to ask you about your recent publication. The book is called Goodbye Africa.
Good day, Martin. Great to be here. And you want to know about Goodbye Africa?
Oh, it came across to me because I grew up in Nigeria as a child, as an interesting subject to intersect with today's politics and cultural affairs, if you want so. From your perspective, I take it, you spent a long time in Africa.
Well, I did spend a long time in Africa. I was an African. Now I'm an Australian.
You sure?
Oh, well, 50-50.
Okay.
So now I'm an Australian, and when I tell people from Africa and I meet them overseas, you know, I see black people and I say I'm an African, and they don't believe me because a white person calling himself an African is a bit odd. So we're talking about modern politics, okay?
No, your book is not about that.
Exactly.
I just wanted to
bring
up the reason why we're doing this interview.
Yes. You raise a very interesting point indeed. So my book is autobiographical, and I was a political activist as a student. I was the head of NUSAS at the University, Rhodes University. I met Steve Biko, who was killed by the police. I actually happened to have a tiny little part in the movie called Cry Freedom about Steve Biko. And that was very interesting. I met Donald Woods, who wrote the book that the movie was based on. Worked with Kevin Kline, Richard Attenborough, and so on. So I'm very interested in the politics, and so interested that in about 1979, I was then in Canberra, and I was watching TV, watching the news, and I was very interested in the insurgency that was going on in Rhodesia with the blacks against the whites. And I noticed one figure which disturbed me a lot, the kill rate of blacks to whites was 20 to 1. And this was Mugabe and his people who were actually based in another country. And that disturbed me quite a lot. I was actually called up by Ian Smith, but fortunately, I was overseas at the time. I wouldn't have joined up anyway. Certainly, I wouldn't have joined up. Then I noticed from my little place in Glebe, Sydney, watching TV, that the kill rate had gone down to 10 to 1. And then eventually, a settlement occurred. And Robert Mugabe was elected at the first democratically held elections ever in the history of that country, and he had a landslide victory. I couldn't help myself. In 1982, I went to the phone, I dialed through to Zimbabwe, I asked to speak to the general manager of ZTV. I said,
Zimbabwe television.
Zimbabwe television, yes. And the way I put it was, this is a call from Australia for the general manager, please. Put me right through. Hello, general manager here. This is Desmond Bishop, and I'm rather interested in working for your company. And I got a job. And I became assistant head of television production. Now, of course, I was working with the comrades. There were very, very few white people left in the broadcasting corporation there. I'm a sort of drongo. It's a bird that flies in when the others are flying out. And I took my family over there. I was the assistant head of television production. And we had 4.5 absolutely wonderfully idyllic years. My kids went to the primary school, which is now mixed race, mainly black.
Yeah.
The multiracialism was absolutely incredible. We loved it. I went out into the wilderness. I stayed alone with all the great, the five big animals, the lions, the leopards, the buffalo, the hyenas, and so on, all of my, just sleeping under my little mosquito net. And so I experienced that in quite some depth. Mm. And the Zimbabwean wilderness was wonderful. However, I end up writing a book, Goodbye Africa.
Yeah, that's what I was coming to. How did you come to write it? How did this thought form? Is this a long time ago? You not just recently.
It's a long time ago. I was in Canberra at the stage. I'd gone back to Canberra to my little safe haven, uh-huh. Canberra. And I had seen what I call in the book the writing on the wall. And there is a video of the production that I did in Zimbabwe, and I was actually asked to produce for television a dance drama production by the National Dance Company called Mbuya Nihanda. And this was based on a high priestess who was hanged by the British when they came in the 1890s.
Yeah.
I actually, before I made this program for TV commemorating the anniversary of independence in 1984, I went and met Mbuya Nyanda. She had been reincarnated, and I went into the village, and it was an interesting experience. But when you got to the edge of the village, you had to take your shoes off and you had to crawl up to her hut. And I went with my assistant director with me, and we went in there, and she spoke to us, and she reprimanded my black assistant. And she said, you should be dressing like your white producer because he's wearing dark clothes. I had a dark blue shirt on and black, and those were the good colors, apparently. And anyway, I went on to produce Mbuya Nyahanda. I have a copy of this on DVD. It's part of it is on YouTube and so on. And that was, if you like, my favorite production ever.
Mm.
But
why is this? Because it truly reproduces or represents the values and the culture of that time, of the people.
Exactly.
The way it's produced.
Exactly. Oh, yes. So I actually just adapted it for TV.
So you didn't rush in there like a BBC kind of industry
team? Absolutely not. Okay. Absolutely not.
Just clarify that. Thank
no.
You.
Totally traditional culture with a traditional perspective.
Yeah.
And it was about the arrival of the first white people.
Oh.
And Mbuya Nyahanda actually predicted it. She was a shaman. She said, soon the locusts will be arriving. This is before the whites came in. And then one of the chieftains came in and said, he had seen them arrive. And he said, they are people with no knees, because they were soldiers and had long trousers and they walked with no legs. And this is all on there. And then they were forced to hand over the land to Cecil John Rhodes and his gentlemen. And they had to pay taxes. They had to work for the white people in order to stay on the land and so on. And there is a picture that I saw in the archives of this lady hanging from the tree, and that was Mbuya Nyahanda. Also, I saw another picture in the Zimbabwean archives, and this was called, the title of this picture was called The Christmas Tree. And there were these white settlers standing around this tree, and hanging by a whole lot of ropes were various black people that were hanging, and they sent it overseas and called it The Christmas Tree. Now, you know,
That's pretty hard hitting.
it's hard hitting, and yeah. I've got that picture on the video and so on.
Which sort of lets me ask you, there must be a strange feel of tension or something being a white person working with these new liberated people in Zimbabwe who were just trying to get rid of the white colonial.
There was a strange tension. There was a strange tension. So I was in charge of the program producers and the studio, but then there was the current affairs people, and these were the radicals. These were all the ex-combatants and so on. And I remember getting a lift back from an ex-combatant, and he was obviously a different kind of person from me. His perspective was different. But when I got out of the car in the car park, I said to myself, why is it that it is the white people who are racist? Here I'm in the company of this man who's doing me a favor, and I'm not picking up any racism towards me, and yet I am the white person. And I think this is, I wonder how true this is. Why does the world regard black as evil and white as pure?
Well, not the world, but the central part of European colonization.
I love indigenous cultures, and I go back to Asia and Thailand. That's an original culture, never been colonized. But I don't understand why they revere white skin, and their dark skinned people are tend to be looked down on. And I don't understand that. I wonder what the answer is.
Well, that might be stuff for another program, perhaps.
Yeah, indeed.
But let's come back to your publication, Goodbye Africa. When you go through the book, it immediately appears you have two parts in the book. And can you explain why you separated your autobiography into two parts?
Yes. So I've taken it out of chronology. And I first wrote the whole thing from when I was the baby. And I thought, let's take it out of chronology and let's play the major cards first. When you're doing a theatre production, you always start with your strongest card, you know, and then you finish with a strong card. And I think this is a good principle.
Can you just give our listeners an impression what the first part deals with?
The very, very, very first part is when I'm a tiny little boy.
Part one of the book.
All right, but part one of the book is there I am sitting on the 14th floor in my SATV, South African Television office. And I'm a producer, and this is 1976. The Soweto riots are going on. I can see the smoke over the horizon, and I'm producing preschool programs, okay? But then I learn about the workings of SATV, and that it is controlled by Die Broederbond, which is the Brotherhood, okay? And still the fierce apartheid politics.
So the
John
money
Forster.
In this case, the finance governs still the black productions there.
Yes, yes.
And influences, obviously.
Yeah. And you see, this was, to me, this was a very interesting part of my life. It was sort of going back. I left Sydney then. I was working for the ABC before that and for a year, and then I went over there because I thought John Forster, his media propaganda was quite sort of positive, and I thought, oh, there are changes, but I went back. My God, there were no changes. And with these riots, these young kids being killed by the police for protesting. And I remember going up to a meeting with the administrators, and I was walking down the passageway, and one of the senior administrators says, "Ach, the trouble is we haven't killed enough of them." Mm. That was the solution. Mm. And that...
There's your racism.
Oh, my God. And one little anecdote in the novel, I'm sitting there and I'm having a lunch break from recording my preschool program, and my presenter bursts into my office and says, "Do you know what?" I say, "What?" "Do you know that downstairs in the canteen, the SABC canteen, there is a black person having lunch?"
Oh God, it sounds like the xenophobia in this country with refugees.
Absolutely. And I said to her, "Hang on, if you just walk across the room, just go to the window and you'll see, look outside, you'll see this place is teeming with black people. It's called Africa." But then you talk about the racism here. Oh, Martin. Oh, Martin. When I first arrived here, I worked for the ABC. I don't think they employed a single Aboriginal person. And I came to the conclusion in 1975, when I was in Australia, that actually the racism in Australia is deeper than South Africa.
No wonder. I mean, they had it so easy, you know. But it was 1 or 2 million people they had to deal with.
Exactly. So you had the numbers
no,
game.
No, well, like, it's completely reversed, the picture compared with African yes. colonization.
Yes, 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 yeah, yes.
Where the majority were always yes. black people. Coming back to the separation of part one, part two, is this then right to say that part one gives the reader an overview of the cultural, political context of the time and the places you've been?
Exactly, exactly. That's exactly what I'm doing.
That's how I understood.
That's
it.
Precisely why I did that.
Just to give the listener an idea of what to expect.
Yes, and, yes.
Can we delve into the lengthier part two?
Mm-hmm.
You've been describing in detail a lot of movements in and out of Africa, actually.
Yes, yes. So there I'm
now, I don't want to make you tell all the whole story again, but
don't
what
worry.
Came to me
don't
as
worry.
A question...
Yes.
What sort of would you take out now, today, from your memory, like retrospective, looking at the memories, how do you see Africa shaping up in the future?
Oh, my God.
I mean, Africa is a huge continent. I don't want to generalize it, but the parts you've been to.
Right. Well, first of all, if I could just narrow it down to Zimbabwe, I still regard Zimbabwe as the most beautiful country on earth. I'm talking about the geographical features. I'm talking about the wildlife, which certainly when I was there were being conserved. When I was there, I actually had a meeting with Victoria Chitepo, who is the Minister for Conservation. And I thought she was marvelous. Mm-hmm. She was an ex-insurgent, actually, and her husband was a very senior member of ZANU-PF. So I do find Africa is an incredible place, if you like, geographically, also culturally. I love the indigenous culture there. I went in and I actually took a teaching job. I said, can you please allocate me a position in the most remote school in the country? Mm. And this guy had never been there. And he said, well, yeah, this year in the middle of the Zambezi Valley. And I went off there. And it was marvelous. And I actually met the lion man there, the shaman, who came to talk to me. And that was a very fascinating experience. Mm. I've never experienced anything like that in my life. And I had a great deal of respect for that man. But today, you see, I mean, as we... today I'll be going back and I'm writing out a proposal to SBS to go back to Africa, Zimbabwe, Zambia, and South Africa, all different shades of formerly British colonialism and now British shades of African nationalism. And maybe I will call the documentary "Hello Africa."
That'd be lovely.
And I want to see what is happening there, because Mugabe has been...
You talk about Mugabe because he's so controversial.
He is so controversial.
In the Western media, at least, we don't really get a clear picture of what this man was and is about.
Absolutely not. And to illustrate that, I went to the BBC about a year ago, and I wanted to make a documentary about Zimbabwe, and they agreed that I could do it, they would sponsor it, but they said, you will never be able to go back. And I said, why? Because what you make about Zimbabwe, they will not let you back. I said, no, I make my documentary, I don't make your documentary. And what they've got to see, the whole Western media are demonizes him, so you don't get the truth of the matter. Mm. Now, I know, for instance, there's a lot of marvelous cultural stuff happening in Zimbabwe right now, today. You can go to the White Enclave, they have their repertory company. It used to be called Salisbury Reps, but they couldn't change the name to Harare Reps, so now it's just called Reps. Mm. But what they're doing is they're producing the old traditional West End productions. The last pantomime was Robinson Crusoe and so on, and a lot of the West End musicals and so on. But also it is multiracial now. Then also you've got the black company, the Chipao Company, run by the daughter of the man that Stephen Chifunisa. Stephen Chifunisa was a writer of a soap opera, the black soap opera that I produced in Zimbabwe. He became the Minister for Education under Mugabe, and he's founded this black theatre in education company, travels all over the world. It is doing extremely well, very active. Mm. And this is all stuff happening under Mugabe's time in office. But it's not getting through to the media. Mm. Of course, but Mugabe is a, well, you know, he's a naughty boy. There's no doubt about that, because he likes to rile particularly the British. He has a very strong relationship, always had done, with the Chinese. When I was there, I saw this firsthand. And I think today, I'm pretty sure the relationship with the Chinese is still very strong. Whereas in Zambia, across the Zambezi River, I believe there the president is pulling back, wants to pull back the influence of the Chinese there. So I'm very interested in the dynamics there.
Destroying the beauty of his country with the mining operations, I suppose.
Well, yeah.
And that is what the Western focus now is on Africa. It's a new sweatshop labor place for first world economies, and it's become a mining and energy resource place to be dug up, you know, no matter what.
And I'm rather interested to see that the Zambian president is wanting to pull this back, and I want to go there and find out more about that. Also, I want to speak to Robert Mugabe, because I want to try and get the truth of the matter is, because I saw him do some very, very good things there. The man was imprisoned without trial for 8 years, you know, in the most appalling conditions. Why? Because he wanted equal rights. So that's what he's been
How can
through.
You ask for that?
How can you ask for it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I'd love to see what the real story is. Maybe I can do a separate documentary on the life and times of Robert Mugabe. I mean, I was a trusted member of the media in those days. Whether I can use that as a platform to get back and liaise with them, I'll be finding out. I'm speaking to the Zimbabwe embassy at the moment.
You've got the carousel going, the proverbial one.
The carousel. Yes, you mentioned the carousel. This is the tiny little merry-go-round.
This is how the story of this book starts. Dear listener, that's why I put that in. And I'd like to, before we wind up the whole story here, what would you recommend to the Australian government in racial relation experience? Or is there anything you could possibly contribute to this country for improvement?
Oh, my God, that's a very good question.
It's a bit off your continent, you know.
Oh, no. I mean, I'm an Australian.
Yeah, you are. That's why I sort of like to...
No doubt about it, man. I'm telling you. Yeah, too right. Yeah.
Fair dinkle.
I've got to practice my stride, you see, to keep my passport. Oh, well, how the hell do you expunge the racism in this country?
We said it is reverse in proportions compared with African colonization and other places in the world, as we have a majority of whites invading this place with a minority of blacks, you know, Aboriginal people.
Exactly, exactly.
So there's other circumstances, and yet we are all aspiring to human rights and to improvements. Everybody in politics is procrastinating on it, isn't it?
To be perfectly honest, I'm not sure whether it's too late, because I think the Aboriginal culture is the most wonderful culture. I mean, I love all Indigenous cultures, and this culture is the most ancient culture in the universe, all right? It is the most marvelous culture, but when the missionaries stopped them speaking their own language, took kids away from their parents, and a lot of that language I know has been lost amongst the Aborigines themselves. They've taken away their culture. It's cultural genocide that you're up against. Can that be reinstated?
I wouldn't ask for that, but... What would be the way forward from, if you see any way forward from your point of view? Are these movements accurate to try and to preserve these languages and preserve something in a museum which is completely incompatible, in my view, with Western civilization as we know it?
Absolutely.
So is it actually possible to make it compatible?
Well, I mean, there are people who are doing it.
And most genuine, willing people amongst whites trying to help their lot. They're trying to make it effectively only compatible.
The whites,
they're not really actually supporting their culture, you know.
It has to be done by the blacks. And I was very pleased to see that on Australia Day, the senior Australian of the year, and I don't know her name, was an Aboriginal woman in her 90s that has spent her whole life trying to preserve the language and the culture of her people, and she's been working at it, and there are people doing that, and that's the way it's got to go, really. And whether they can bring that up and give the Aborigines that pride in their culture. You see, why do I like Indigenous cultures? Because when Indigenous cultures die off, I'm the loser, you're the loser, because we are enriched by these Indigenous cultures that are different from ours. And one of the reasons why I like going to Asia, because it's a totally different cultural paradigm to Western culture. And I find the energy there marvelous. And I find this too with Indigenous cultures here. And I've had very little contact in Australia with it. I've had quite a lot in Africa. But we are the richer for their cultures being alive. Really, truly, because to be enclosed in our own Judeo-Christian Western culture, I'm afraid, is a box that I try to scramble out of. Yeah.
No, it is not an easy question to solve, because the young generation of Aboriginals is quite well tuned into all Western affluent ways of life, and they have no barriers to attain the same aims as white kids do in many ways, you know. So it's not all across the board.
No, but they have no barriers, what, to become westernized? And
yeah. Well, or to follow the Western whatever.
Exactly.
The next computer or whatever they are, or the next X Factor competitor win, you know, celebrity.
Well, maybe we need to start to digitize some of the Aboriginal culture so that gets on.
Well, that's certainly done. That's certainly on the way.
And you see, I mean, that SBS production of the first Australians, I thought was extremely good. And there you had the Aboriginal commentators commenting on the writings of the first, not the first Australians, but of the English who came over, and interpreting them, and I thought it was a very revealing and very positive documentary series. We need more and more of that.
Well, Desmond, it was lovely to talk to us, and last question, you're already on the next project I saw on your website.
Oh yes,
it's underway.
That's right. So my
give us an inkling.
Okay, so that is my next project. Oh, is The Wizard of Zee. And that is set in ancient Gondwana land, and of course, Gondwana land was the supercontinent. Yeah. Was one of two great continents.
Look, Pangaea was the supercontinent. Yeah.
Then you had Laurasia, which was the northern,
and
Gondwana land, which was Africa, Australia, India, Arabia, South America.
But it's not a geological survey you're writing about.
Well, not exactly. It's not. The fact is not
so
strong on
the
ground.
We're staying on novel and
it is fantasy
biography material.
Yeah, it is
fantasy. Is it more biography material, or what are you aiming with?
That is a very naughty question, and I remember somebody complaining that all these writers, all these novelists, they always write the same story over again.
Oh, of course they do.
But of course, actually, I suppose you could say it is my life in metaphor. And it's about a little boy who escapes from home and goes and lives in the wilderness and lives with nature and learns to be the person who he really is and learns magic and works with the shamans. And then there's a threat of great invasion of Gondwana land by the muted buffalo, Prince Bogar. And he's told to go off there and fight war with peace. Uh-huh. And they have their own little device for converting the mutant buffaloes into decent buffaloes and not pretend human beings.
But don't
beings.
Give it all away, Desmond.
Oh, no.
Well,
there's a lot more.
Thank you very much for your time, Desmond. I hope the listeners will Google you up. Just Google Goodbye Africa by Desmond Bishop will be the first listing on the Google Index. My name's Martin. Thanks very much for listening, and catch you soon.
Thank you, Martin.